This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Melbourne on Joy 94.9 and streaming online at joy.org.au, you're listening to Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12.
So who have we got on next, Macca?
Catherine.
No, we haven't. We've got Kim.
Oh, we've got Kath and Kim. Kath and Kim. Jesus.
Good morning, Kim.
My mind's been Barnaby.
Kimmy.
Good morning.
Yeah, so Kim McGrath. Kim joined us on the phone on the 6th of January, and we spoke about a lovely and wonderful book that she's written called Crossing the Line, which is a bit of a history of the relationship between Australia and East Timor and some of the shenanigans that have gone on by our government, who've done some great things in East Timor, but really have done some...
We're going to learn more about that.
We're
going to
learn
morning.
About it. And we've got Catherine back, Kim back. God.
Good morning, Kimmy.
Hi, Kimmy. You can give me a slap for an extended chat. So welcome, Kim.
Thank you, Macca.
Now, I've got to tell the story, this little story.
And I've got one to tell as well.
I didn't actually know that Kim and Tass knew each other. And I was, you know, as I was on Twitter and I saw some tweets that Kim had posted about her book. And, you know, so usual thing, you know, you go to Google and you do this stuff. And I thought, you know, this is a really interesting subject. We'd had chats before about East Timor, and I can't think of his name. It's escaped me now. It used to be a Fin Review journalist.
Oh, Mark Scully.
Mark Scully.
Yep.
On a number of occasions. And I thought, you know, this is a really interesting subject. I want to talk about this. So I reached out to Kim and we contacted, had her on. I then found out subsequently that you and Tass are friends, and so I didn't actually know.
Well, actually, my story relates to how I, why I ended up buying a copy of Kim's book. So I was at a bush doof at the end of last year.
I bought a copy last week.
Oh, well, I've had mine for a while, but I was at a bush doof at the end of last year, and
it's
gonna
be embarrassing.
We're having a glass of wine, and I approached Kim and said, "How's the book going?" And Kim says, "Well, have you got a copy yet? Everybody in the country should have one. This is really important reading, and people need to know what happened."
Yes.
So, of course, I went and bought a copy of the book, and I've got it here with me today because I want you to sign it for me, Kim.
Yes. Love to.
So it's right there.
Now,
right there. I haven't read it yet, though, I have to confess. Kim rolls her eyes.
Yes. Now, last time we spoke, some of the matters were, if I'm correct, we were subject to an upcoming AAT hearing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Has that happened yet?
No. That's scheduled for 5 days at the first week of March of okay. May. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. Well, a little bit of context. What's all that mean? Yeah. What's the AAT hearing and what's that about?
Okay. So my book's based on looking at thousands of documents in the Australian National Archives, and a lot of them have been declassified. Well, and this is documents back.
They weren't in a filing cabinet, were they?
No, but I did have some interesting files that were told. I was told they were lost.
Ah.
The archives couldn't find a particular file, and that they tried to tell me that meant because they couldn't find it, even though it existed on the database and I had the files either side of it, that I should just, you know, pack up my bags and not worry about it. So I pushed that with them and raised that with the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, and we had an emergency hearing, and it was very Kafkaesque. But it ended up that I had to... that the months went by, and then I got a letter eventually from them saying, "Oh, we've found the file." It was, and despite they'd done all these searches, and it was because it was marked top secret, it should have been only kept in particular, very sort of safe processes.
Apparently safe processes.
Yeah. And they'd scanned the minister's offices, and they'd scanned all these filing cabinets in the Department of Foreign Affairs and in the National Archives. And then miraculously, they found it in a filing, in a safe. that they'd examined previously but hadn't noticed that it was tucked underneath the files right down the back of this safe. And that file turned out to be a goldmine of really useful information. But even though, so these files are from the 1970s, so well over the 30-year
rule, yeah.
Rule. they've still got massive amounts of redactions in them. So you'll be reading a file where it says this now's a good time to negotiate with Indonesia about a maritime boundary from, say, 1972 because... And then it's just all blacked out.
Yeah.
So it's those files that, with all those redactions, are the ones that I've got about 20 different files that I'm challenging at the Administrative Appeals Tribunal because I can't see how it's not in our national interest to have access to those files from, you know, 40 years ago. And, yeah, so it'll be, yeah, stay tuned on that.
So I can feel book number two coming up.
I hope so. Yeah, because I think there's a lot more to this story that has come out to date.
Sounds great.
Now, so recently there's been some new agreements signed.
So is this the new treaty, Mac?
The new treaty? Is it classified as a treaty or is it a...
I think it will be a treaty. So what's come out... So this is the United Nations Compulsory Conciliation Hearing, which... when Timor had exhausted all its attempts to negotiate, so a maritime boundary agreement, and there's this sort of complexity that one of the... Alexander Downer, when he was foreign minister back in 2002, just before Timor became independent, he withdrew Australia from the maritime jurisdiction of the international courts, which meant once Timor became independent, it couldn't challenge Australia in the International Court of Justice. In the same way that Australia took Japan... to the ICJ, for example, about whaling and won that case. So Timor wasn't able to have its day in court with Australia about that, which is why they've had to resort to all these other sort of tortuous negotiations over the years. And when they'd exhausted the negotiations and after the spying allegations and that treaty all fell over, Timor used a clause in the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea that had never been used by any country in the world before, and it enabled them to take Australia to a compulsory conciliation. That's non-binding, and initially Australia, they reluctantly went along because they didn't want to look like China in the South China Sea and have comparisons about not being a good international citizen. But the first thing they did when they got there was challenge the jurisdiction of the hearing and try and get out of it. They lost that, and so then they were forced to play ball. And from what I've sort of heard around the traps, they've initially Australia was quite belligerent and very difficult. But there seemed to be a bit of a turning point about probably 6 to 12 months ago. And since then, there have been a series of hearings all around the world in Copenhagen, Singapore, Sydney last week. And it sounds like they're, well, in September last year, they announced that they had reached an agreement on a maritime boundary, and they were still working out the details of it, and they hadn't announced the details. And then just last week, interestingly, in the Portuguese media...
It was a former Portuguese colony.
Yes. So the Portuguese have paid a lot more attention to this issue than we have.
We Australians.
And this hasn't been picked up in the Australian media, but on Monday this week, this story came out that there'd been a... an agreement on a median line, which was a detail that hasn't been confirmed, and I sort of don't know if this is true, but it was in the Portuguese media, and they're saying it was from a good source, so that Australia has agreed on a line halfway between Australia and Timor, which is what Timor's been asking for forever, and it's what Indonesia and Portugal initially asked for in the early 70s. And then it also says that they're going to have a resource-sharing arrangement, though, still for the Greater Sunrise Field.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that was the one that was discovered by Woodside back in 1974, just before Indonesia invaded. And that was the one that was the subject of that treaty where there were the spying allegations.
Yes.
And they're saying in the Portuguese media that there'll be a revenue sharing arrangement with Timor-Leste will get 70% if there's a pipeline and it's processed in Timor, and 80% if it goes to Darwin. And that detail hasn't come out before.
So, Kim, what does all that mean?
Media.
What does it mean, sort of, in practical terms?
if this story is true, what it means in practical terms for Timor is it's going to guarantee their economic future. And while I'm still a bit unhappy about the fact that Australia's sort of claiming any part of the pie, because I still think it's all on Timor's side of the line, but at the end of the day, you know, politics is the art of compromise
persuasion.
And persuasion, and I don't think this would have happened without Shanana Gusmao behind the scenes, because they've cut a deal with, they've got, if they end up with a permanent maritime boundary based on the median line, which is what they've been calling for years, that is huge. And even though there's a revenue sharing split with the Greater Sunrise Field, that's estimated to be between 40 to 50 billion worth. So that could guarantee, even not 100% share, that could guarantee Timor's future.
Because it is a small country and not a huge population, very little infrastructure. Well, what there was, the Indonesians mostly destroyed when they left.
Yep.
I'm interested, so 70% if the oil was
Processed in Timor,
but 80% in Darwin. Why is that?
Because I think both countries, if this is true, both countries recognise that there are other economic benefits from having it processed onshore. Mm-hmm. And Timor-Leste was very unhappy about... there's another field that, again, is on the Timor side of the median line that's processed in Darwin. And that's been a big issue ever since then. Timor, Shanana Gusmao in particular, has been passionate about wanting a pipeline to Timor and to have that economic development onshore, yeah, so that they get the benefit of the jobs and infrastructure. And they've looked at what's happened in a lot of other resource-rich, poor countries around the world, in Africa and other places, who have just exported all their mineral wealth and said, we don't want to do that. We want to invest in local jobs and education. And so that's still an issue that to be determined.
Okay.
Now, if you just tuned in, you listen to Macca and Tass here on Saturday Magazine, and we have Kim McGraw in the studio, who is the author of Crossing the Line, Australia's Secret History into the Timor Sea.
It could actually be a book about us.
Kath and Kim.
No, Crossing the Line.
So, Kim.
Tass.
Before we go back into talking about some of the issues, what was it like writing the book? What was your experience of that?
It was a very intense experience. I'd been researching and working on a PhD about this, which is why I've been trawling through the archives. And as more and more journalists got sacked from various media outlets around the country, and as the issue became more relevant, when it was clear that this view and hearing was happening, and I thought, someone else is going to pop up and write a book about this unless I stick my head out and try and make it happen. And I was really frustrated that the story that I was reading about in the archives had been completely written out of Australians' history books, including a lot of official histories that had been written. And I wanted to get it out while the issue was still relevant. And I still think, even if a deal's been done on this, on the Timor Sea issue, the story that I found in the archives about the cover-up of Australia's involvement leading up to the Indonesian invasion, and then worse still, the cover-up of the mass starvation and atrocities going on in Indonesia, in East Timor through the 70s and 80s. And my argument is that the reason that we were complicit in covering that up was because we had to, in order to negotiate to get a maritime boundary, which we needed to do because we had big international oil companies, Shell, ConocoPhillips, that we'd issued these permits to, banging on the door in Canberra constantly saying, we need security, we're not going to invest the billions involved in further exploration until you can tell us there's a permanent boundary line. And that meant for Australia, after the invasion, when the rest of the world was condemning Indonesia's invasion, and at the UN calling on Indonesia to leave, Australia became the only Western country in 1978-79 to recognise Indonesian occupation, and that was explicitly in the archives so that they could negotiate a maritime boundary and appease the oil companies. And so that particular 5 years when 200,000 people died...
So it wasn't driven by, our desire... to support human rights and democracy entirely. It was a commercial decision as well.
Yeah, I mean, they said at the time publicly that the reason why they had to recognise Indonesia's oppression was to be able to provide humanitarian aid, and that had to be, that would be more efficient if it could be, if we just got over it, recognised Indonesia was in there, and that shows up in the archives. That was all deliberately spun. When the real reason was that they were caught in this sort of catch-22, that they had to recognise the occupation in order to negotiate a treaty over that territory.
So what's driven you? Why have you developed this passion and interest in East Timor and what's occurring here?
I sort of ended up getting involved quite accidentally. I'd worked for Steve Brax as a policy advisor in the Victorian government for 7 years, and then when he resigned, I'd taken long service leave just before he resigned, and I got a phone call out of the blue from him asking me if I'd help him with on a three-month project when he was going to do pro bono advice for Shanana Gusmao, and I'd be sort of behind the scenes advising the advisor. And at that stage, there were 100,000 people living in IDP camps around Dili.
IDP?
Oh, sorry, in displaced person, internal displaced persons camps. There'd been a lot of internal strife. And anyway, we went up for a couple of trips in late 2007, and it was like going into a sort of war zone area. It was there were the only cars on the road were UN cars and police cars. No one went out after dark. It was quite a sort of hairy setup. And since then, I've done 42 trips back and forth with Steve over the last 10 years. And Timor itself has been, and Dili's been absolutely transformed. It's been amazing what they've done from a situation, as you said, Macca, that was completely destroyed. And there wouldn't be one family up there that hasn't been traumatised by and touched by horrible deaths and a history of terrible things happening. And yet they've managed to build a, you know, Dili's now a vibrant, thriving city where, you know, used to take 10 minutes to get anywhere. Now it takes 30 because there's traffic jams and, you know, it's a... Yeah, they've done a fabulous job. But my interest in the oil issue came when we first started going up. We were told in one meeting that we couldn't talk about the oil issue and the maritime boundary. It was off records. And that didn't make sense to me. And when I started doing some Google research about how it was that Australia was claiming this, in particular this field, Greater Sunrise, it was clearly on the Timor side of the halfway line. The only information I could find, and particularly coming out of DFAT and things, was all very, you know, technical and obscure and referring to all these millions of treaties. And then by chance I came across all this material in the National Archives that had been digitalised, and so I was able to read the original files, and then I just started tracking back over the history, and then that interest turned into the PhD. And then it was not wanting to wanting to get the story out to a broader audience.
A
broader audience was why I sort of put the PhD on hold to do the book.
So how far are you into your PhD?
I hope I've finished all the research, although subject to this hearing I've got coming up with the AAT, if there's any interesting additional information comes out there. I've drawn the line. I'm concentrating on the 60s and 70s for the PhD. And because that is a period, and particularly that, you know, around the story of Australia's response to the invasion, another thing that led me down that path was I found there was a book, a lot of publications put out by DFAT, their history unit, and they purport to tell the story of Australia's foreign policy engagement. And when I started looking at the material put out by DFAT, I realised that they were material about Portugal. There was a full-blown diplomatic dispute with Portugal just before the invasion, where Portugal had issued permits to an American company that overlapped 7 permits. So billions of dollars of oil and gas permits were at stake, plus Australia's reputation with all these major oil companies. And that's been written out of all the official histories about Australia's involvement in 75, as if somehow...
didn't happen.
And an economic interest in billions of dollars is not relevant to Australia's foreign policy. Like, it's the only area of analysis where you can get away with suggesting that.
Jeez.
Have you had any feedback that you can tell us about from the government or DFAT? Are they happy with what you've written?
Good question, Macca.
If you're listening, Julie.
They've been very, very silent. There was one comment. One piece has been written on the Lurie interpreter site. From an officer who was involved in the negotiations in 72. But that was there's quite a sort of technical discussion going on there that I'm in the process of responding to. But no, otherwise I'm being studiously ignored.
Well, that says something in itself.
Well, if you look out the window, there's probably a long-range lens and microphone. Look, I think I'm interested in this because it's one of our nearest neighbours. Australia has, you know, going back decades, has had an involvement in East Timor, and the Timorese people, you know, were crucial supporters of Australia during the Second World War. Yep. Very, very crucial. We think about New Guinea, but the Timorese as well. The relationship with Indonesia in this, the Whitlam government's involvement in this. There's a lot of detail, and I really thank you for writing it because, okay, it's not an LGBTI issue, but it's about Australia, it's about us, it's about our engagement in the region, and what our governments, all of them, have done ostensibly in our name. And, you know, they've certainly got crude oil on their hands, if not blood.
One of the fascinating things that's come out is that, well, that I've seen in the archives is the way that what actually happens in Cabinet and then what they deliberately go out and tell the Australian public. And we got a hint of that with some of the material that came out in the Cabinet files from in the mystery file in Cabinet last week. And
I bet you would have loved to have had a rifle through them.
Oh, yes. I think there's a missed opportunity there.
Yes.
Do you have a file in Cabinet at home?
It's all in the cloud.
It's all in the cloud.
Oh, well, they don't need to unlock it.
It's all there. Very transparent.
I told this story a few weeks ago, but when I worked in the public service, I had a four-drawer filing cabinet full of stuff, and I took it. I literally dragged the filing cabinet from office to office as I changed jobs during my career. And over a 10-year period, I had this filing cabinet. I stopped looking inside the filing cabinet. Didn't even know what was in the end, really.
Yeah.
Then I ended up in a job. It was actually the Western region of the Health Department, and I forgot to take my filing cabinet with me.
So it's lurking around somewhere.
And in the end, I've no idea what happened to the filing cabinet, but I don't actually miss a single thing that was in there. Which is even funnier, really.
It's probably in a garage somewhere.
Who knows? Full of Tass's stuff.
So, Kim, published by...
Black Ink.
Black Ink, yes. And we've actually had a few Black Ink books on the show.
Yeah. It's
Murray Short, he's amazing.
Yes. Extraordinary.
It's the quarterly essay. We've had a couple of quarterly essay authors here.
Saturday Paper, the Monthly Magazine, and the Saturday Paper.
So Crossing the Line by Kim McGrath, buy it, because it's a bloody good read. It's an important story. And if you buy it, then we'll get a second book.
And I'd like you to sign my book before you leave.
So there you go,
Kim.
Delighted.
Kath.
Kath.
Hi, this is John Borghetti, the CEO of Virgin Australia. Just like Joy 94.9, we are flying high and proud.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.